as the first day of the week was dawning, writes Matthew. Very early on the first day of the week, when the sun had risen, says Mark. On the first day of the week, at early dawn, reads Luke. But according to John, while it was still dark, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb and saw that the stone had been removed. John, notes Raymond Brown, the late great Johannine scholar. For all that the empty tomb means to Mary is that the body has been stolen, that her dead friend's remains were missing. But death was the final fact she could know about her life and his, about your life. John, in another sense. In him was life, and the life was the light of all people, wrote John at the beginning. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not overcome it. John's gospel is riddled with characters who must decide with their lives between the light and the darkness. The majority invariably walk in darkness, stumble in darkness, dwell in darkness, choosing the settled claims of religion and culture rather than being claimed by revelation, by the life of him who is the light of the world. Put another way on this morning, while it is still dark, John is saying to us, who have become unwitting characters in his story by virtue of our walking into a church on Easter morning, he is saying that we are in the dark concerning the meaning and purpose of our lives racing toward death, so long as we believe that he is dead and not alive. Return with me then to Mary, who at this point in the story has nothing more than an empty tomb to go on. They have taken the Lord out of the tomb, she says to the disciples, and we do not know where they have laid him. 2,000 years later, with nothing more than an empty tomb to go on, how are we to decide between the darkness we know and the unfathomable light that is his resurrection? At least Mary was there. But we are here. The tomb may have been empty then, but this is now. How can it be between there and here, between then and now, that we should come to believe that he is alive? Though we take our cues from John's characters, being alive and present at his birth, his ministry, his arrest and crucifixion, or even being around after his rising did not make the choice between the darkness and the light any easier. Then and there, no less than here and now, the question was not a question of what to do with the facts as they were before them. It is a question, and was a question, of whether to trust their lives into the keeping of the God who in Jesus Christ has come to them. But we are getting ahead of ourselves. For on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, we with Mary think that it is an empty tomb with which we are having to do this morning. Standing outside the tomb, what keeps us from choosing the darkness here and now? tolerance for a particular four-letter word. I recommend you see what I take to be a sympathetic critique of all religions. The play's bottom line is that the unreasonable claims of faith can be useful if they are understood metaphorically. The Book of Mormon is an especially easy target, according to Andrew Sullivan, because its claims were so recently concocted. Armed with the story of Joseph Smith and the golden plate buried somewhere in New York State, the most unlikely of Mormon missionaries finally must face the fact that this story is not helpful to Ugandans dying of AIDS and living under the murderous threats of a warlord. At a loss, he begins to make up a story that turns out to be a more helpful lie than the text he could not himself believe, saying by way of apology to the visitors, the villagers, "It's just a metaphor." I found myself sitting in that audience wondering how absurd the virgin birth or the resurrection must sound to random passers-by of a Sunday morning. To tell you the truth, a metaphor was once as close as I could come to the truth of the resurrection. Which is to say, on the first day of the week, the darkness lingered as I stood outside the tomb, with not much more than an inkling of belief in the living Lord and the faith of Shakespeare's Prospero. Our revels now ended. These are actors, as I foretold you, were all spirits, and are melted in the air, into thin air. And like the baseless fabric of this vision, the cloud-capped towers, the gorgeous palaces, the solemn temples, the great globe itself, yea, all which it inherit shall dissolve. And like this insubstantial pageant faded, leaves not a rack behind. We are such stuff as dreams are made of, and our little life is rounded with a sleep. There are also those on the opposite end of things who would eliminate the ugly broad ditch by holding scripture to be historically inerrant. This is the darkness of religious literalism in the guise of light, of rigid belief in the garb of rigorous theology, a darkness strangely condoned this week by David Brooks in his own critique of the Book of Mormon, the play. He lauds what he calls the dry and schematic map of reality drawn by religion, not because it is true, but because it works to build character, conserve values, control passions. The religions that thrive, Brooks writes, have exactly what the play ridicules: communal theologies, doctrines and codes of conduct rooted in claims of absolute truth. Such were the characters who preferred the darkness in John's Gospel. Such are the characters currently in an uproar over the fallen darling of fundamentalism named Rob Bell, who has questioned the absolute truth of exclusive salvation and eternal damnation. Without hell, counter his critics, why be good? Believing more in the inerrancy of the text than in the living Lord to whom it points, they post themselves outside the empty tomb, lest someone as unorthodox as Jesus presume is life eternally. I repeat, the question of Easter morning is not a question of what to do with the historical facts that before Easter morning we could say were inaccessibly distant to our ways of knowing the truth. It is a question of whether to trust our lives here, now, into the keeping of the God who in Jesus Christ comes to us every moment of this mortal life because he is alive and with us. Lessing's ugly broad ditch, you see, is only relevant if in it we hide ourselves, as we did in the first garden, from his living presence. If because of it we close our eyes in order to take ourselves and our honesty with such frightful seriousness. If it causes us to safeguard ourselves against the truth of death's defeat and the promise of love's triumph with which he confronts us and changes us in the twinkling of an eye. And even if you should choose to hide or close your eyes or safeguard yourself against the life that is the light of the world, the gospel on this Easter Sunday morning is this.